This is the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio.
On the AYG List, I talk with fascinating people, some at the top of their game, others still climbing, all possessing an uncommon commitment to owning their stories and achieving their visions. I'm not a journalist. I'm a deep thinker, a conversationalist. I won't be engaging my guests as a passive, neutral moderator. I have a perspective, an opinion on just about everything. I also navigate sometimes complex conversations that unpack and contextualize current events with thoughtful individuals who represent a diverse array of well-informed and passionately articulated perspectives. In this space, I hope to deepen, broaden, and sometimes even shift my own opinion by opening myself up to the thoughtful insights of others. I invite you to join me on this journey.
Hang out with April on Facebook, peek into her world on Instagram, and follow her on Twitter at the AYG List. Visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog at theayglist.com. And now, April Yvonne Garrett.
He, Jason Moran, is the risk-taking jazz pianist and composer whose awards include Jazz Artist, Jazz Album, and Pianist of the Year by the Downbeat Critics Poll, Playboy Jazz Artist of the Year, and the coveted MacArthur Foundation Genius Fellowship. She, Alicia Hall Moran, is a mezzo-soprano whose diverse influences and uncompromising commitment to her own unique artistic vision has afforded her the opportunity to amplify unique collaborations with the likes of Bill T. Jones and landed her the role of Bess in the traveling tour of the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Together, Alicia and Jason are a force, the most aromatic concoction of love, art, and life you might ever behold in a couple who individually hold their own and collectively live in the grace of knowing they found in one another their perfect match. Jason and Alicia have quite the love and life to behold. Listen. Alicia and Jason, welcome to the AYG List.
Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
Where are each of you right now? It's hard to keep up with you.
Okay, there's our first edit. Is he going to try to talk to me where I'm at?
Alicia, where are you?
Thank you. I'm in Cleveland, Ohio, 5 degrees. It's snowing every day. Mm-hmm. But we are having a great run, a two-week run here of the national tour of Porgy and Bess.
That's so exciting. Congratulations. I'm so happy for you, and I'm happy for your audience. Okay, so Jason, what are you up to?
I'm in New York, looking at the Hudson River from our home. Dropped my kids off at school, so I'm waiting to pick them up for the next five hours.
Okay.
I'm just sitting here waiting to pick them up.
In Harlem. That is also the answer.
Remember Valentine's Day Friday. That's all I got to say. All right, so I was meeting with my mentee yesterday and preparing for this interview, and she asked me who I'd be speaking with. And when I told her, I'm going to be speaking to this beautifully soulful and artistic couple, and one is a mezzo-soprano, and her husband is a jazz pianist and a composer and a MacArthur genius, and her face just lit up, and then her eyes began to squint. And I was like, what's up with the squinting? I don't understand this. What just happened here? And she was both intrigued and confounded all at once. And so I handed her my computer, and I said, Google them. And she discovered Lead, and she discovered your performance at Art Basel, and she got a little teary-eyed, and I'm like, okay, what is going on here? What am I missing? And I'm getting a little choked up as I'm saying it, but she said, I didn't know all of this was possible. Mm. And I thought, okay, it's 2014. What is happening here? So all of the questions that I had prepared for this interview about your accomplishments and your artistic contributions, they're going to have to wait a little bit to the next interview that I have with you, because something really profound happened in that exchange for me. And it just kind of reminded me of that moment where all of us experience along the way that defining moment that allows us to see that a dream we have for our lives is possible. And it might be experienced in a way that opens us up to something that, you know, we never imagined. So my first question for you, and we can start with you, Alicia, is what was that defining moment or experience that gave you permission to believe that life as an artist was possible?
I think I know for sure, though I've never been asked. This is a great question. that it relates entirely to my father telling me at some point after the seventh grade, because that's when we moved to the new house, and that's where I remember this conversation taking place, maybe, you know, seventh grade, my father saying, oh, I think I said I don't need to do good at that, maybe it was a math class or something, because I'm not going to use that. And he said, I don't care what you're going to do, and you should neither. All you need to know is that you are going to be excellent at it. And this kind of thing never from that day went away. Jason could definitely tell you a common word in my childhood was mastery of skill sets. To be clear, it wasn't that I needed to ever be perfect at anything. This is the key point right here. It wasn't that in my house I was required to be perfect or to strive for perfection. My father just really impressed upon me the realism that there is a point at which you would be getting an A. There is amount of work you could be doing wherein you, because I'm raising you and you're a quality person, could be getting an A. Now, with pigs might have to be flying, the world might have to, you know, not spin on the axis, whatever has to happen might have to happen. But there is an amount of work you could do that would get you an A. And that when you arrive at this kind of adulthood, this, like, mythological place where it's all going to be set based on, you know, how hard you worked, which also never arrives. And he, I think, knew that at the time. But the idea that when you get there, you should be involved in things that are about excellence. You should be involved in some good things. So basically don't, you know, try to be half-stepping based on where you think you're going and then get involved in a bunch of garbage. Really try to aim high. You don't have to be perfect, and he's so big on that. Don't have to be perfect, but you should know that, you know, you're in control of how much work you're going to do, and that's probably the only thing you'll ever be able to control.
And Jason, before I get to you, knowing a little bit that I know about Alicia, because we have a little bit of a transcript, because I knew her when she was amazingly bright, and she was a light always. I mean, I remember seeing her during her days at Barnard Columbia, and she was always a light. She was always a force. She was always a presence. And she always had a smile on her face, by the way. And you remember that. But one of the things that was interesting to me about you and your walk, I mean, there has to be a point where the art wins over law school or med school or whatever. I think part of what my mentee was talking about was the way that art gets translated for them is sort of pop culture, hip-hop stuff. And they don't, I think one of her reactions to you and the physicality of your performance, especially the one in Miami, is that she got a different sense of womanhood and about possibility and placement and grace and dignity. But also that art as a choice could be a viable option. Like I could live off of embodying myself as a black woman, as a force who has all of these diverse interests. And it blew her away because, frankly, we're not really seeing that. So part of what I want to get her, and her name is Jessie, by the way, part of what I want you to answer for Jessie is, when was that moment that you believe that the pursuit of some sort of craft work, some sort of mastery toward your goal of being an artist was acceptable and doable for you?
Well, I think an important part about the ideas of excellence and mastery, as my father put them out, was that those are just measurable gradations that you can assign yourself. Yeah. So let it not be forgotten that I'm also a fool. I'm also always trying to kind of subvert the obvious for kind of a better choice that might be a little bit more revealing about the actual how I got there or what I'm feeling right now. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, it always gets read on the outside as ambiguity or as kind of a beautiful mystery, or as kind of like, we don't know what category this is, but we like it, especially when it's free. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
So I've been in a position in my life to be kind of comfortable with people's reactions to me, which is, one, I feel honored about some of the adjectives people who like what I do use when they describe my work. But then, two, like maybe the other way of looking at it is I don't have to care that much what people think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I read and write well, and I made a choice very early on that in my college career, I really rather work a day doing just a J-O-B than kind of use my singing voice or my body to make any kind of art statement that I didn't think was interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that excluded me from a lot of activity that is interesting to other people.
Got it.
And to jobs that might be, girl, they you somebody at, you want they want you, you can get a, you, they pay a lot of money for you, you could,
right.
But like, I don't care, because part of that thing is the mastery that, and I keep saying mastery, but I, that's giving the wrong impression. It could be misquoted so easily. But it was just because of what I wanted to do. I just didn't see finding much glory in being many of the things maybe that were available to me in my early 20s. My mom said, oh, you're born to be 40. That was very depressing when I first heard it, because that was many years ago.
Right.
But I think I know what she meant by that.
Yeah.
And kind of like, there's just something about my persona, like I'm already been done with something before I even got there. Like, I had enough of this being 19 running around. I had enough of this being 15 running. Like, just not my thing. So
you're always ready.
But I just always was done with kind of feeling like I was acting childish for an audience of people from whom I might want something.
Got it.
Money, dates.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's just never been the position I felt comfortable in. And, I mean, it did not make me a winner for, like, a really long time. But,
yeah, I get
But when you stick it out, like, no, I kind of want to, well, you know, I think when you're talking about Miami, that dress by Emilio Sosa, it was a bright coral orange that he designed for me. And it has pleats. So it's like that perfect Connecticut good girl kind of pattern in the fabric, but which is very me. Ladies who lunch, he likes to make jokes about me. I'm not one, but there's a thing that I do give off about that's about being born to be 40, I think. But he pushed that neckline down, and it trails like feet and feet behind me. It has yards and yards of unnecessary fabric and pleats, and when it kicked up in the wind on Miami Beach, I just felt like this is the accident of relationships that my whole professional life has been so blessed with over and over. It's like I allow Emilio Sosa to read me as a real person.
Yeah.
A real person, like what I'm really about up in here. This was at the when I was in my ensemble role at Porgy and Bess on Broadway and understudying Audra. So kind of from that position, you could ostensibly crawl under a rock and just appear when they needed you, you know, at showtime to pick up a bucket. Or they need you, the star is sick, please fill in for tonight. But I just always had a lot of confidence to kind of fill it, not with a bombastic upcoming Broadway star that I would like imagine in my head and then try to be for people.
I
filled it with myself and who I really am, how I really talk. My little mouth got me in some funny kind of little situations sometimes, but I just believe it's just so much better to be honest.
Yeah.
Because then when your name gets tossed about, people are going to say, yeah, well, you know.
Well, and it's
you and
not
a little bit like she sees it.
Right.
Kind
of. It's absolutely you without, you know, if not the press release, it's you. So, Jason, what was your defining moment?
I mean, I played piano since I was age six as a chore for my parents. My brothers and I both did. And I think by age 13, I realized that, not that music was a profession, but I realized that the piano could be an instrument that would be interesting. Mm-hmm. And that alone was displayed to me by Thelonious Monk playing piano. I heard a record of Thelonious Monk. And that made me want to invest more time into the piano. And by that time, I was also entering high school and decided rather than going to the high school that all my cousins and brothers were going to, that I would go to the arts high school where the kids who were, like, pretty strange were all congregating.
Mm-hmm.
All the way through that path and even graduating that high school and moving up to New York and going to Manhattan School of Music, even while I was in school, I wasn't really sure that, because I didn't, my parents are not artists, but they appreciate the arts and
yeah.
have taught us to.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was after I started to move around the world and realize the power of music and what it does for audiences and what it does for the musicians and what it does for culture kind of around the world, and especially jazz,
mm-hmm.
and the freedom that it displays, that, oh, well, this would be the form that could really, you know, that I could probably figure out how to maneuver in. And like Alicia said, sticking, if you actually try to stick something out, you know, for a little bit longer than everybody else, there's a great reward going through that bush that once you get to the other side, you really see a clearing. And in that clearing is like a lot of fertile land. So that's what, you know, also led me to meeting Alicia at Manhattan School of Music, too.
It's interesting because in the conversation that I was having with my mentee yesterday, she was really moved by the optic of the two of you, and especially with that Miami performance. And we got into this exchange about, you know, how did two people who are so clearly powerful in their own singular right come together in such a complementary way? So I would like to know how you navigated seeing each other for the first time, and when you saw each other, what was it like, and how did you navigate that earlier connection between the two of you?
I mean, I'll start, Alicia, mm-hmm. but, I mean, Alicia, you know, as a graduate from Barnard, she entered Manhattan School of Music with a very different mindset than most of the other women that were in the school, let's just say that. And also at most conservatories, there are very few African-Americans, very few.
Mm-hmm.
And so when a beautiful woman comes in with her hair all cut off and like a really kind of talking a very different way about music and everything else, it's extremely exciting. It was exciting for me. And I more or less just kind of figured out her patterns of classes by waiting in the lobby just to see when she would pass by. And, you know, and then we started to have our conversation. But we met in music school. I mean, Alicia will be the first to admit that she went to Barnard for 4 years and got her degree, and then she came to Manhattan School of Music for another 4 years of schooling in music. So that's a total kind of departure from the kind of career she could have had, whether she followed her mother in publishing or her father in finance, but deciding to go into music and actually invest not only some of her, more of her parents' money, but also
mm-hmm.
all of her time. I mean, those are those
yeah.
years when people are trying to figure out what they're supposed to do with their life in their mid-20s, and Alicia decided to be in school, and that's her coming into that school was like the breath of fresh air that I needed, because she also changed my perspective on how to look at, you know, a form like jazz, which, I mean, there's just a lot to contemplate. And also then how she taught me about all of the other music of the world, especially classical music and opera. So that those first meetings were very, you know, were very powerful, though.
Jason, at the time that you met me, I love your answer. So I was thinking of what were the courses in music I was coming with. And I think senior year at Barnard, these courses were taught at Columbia, I was taking an advanced music history class on the music of Duke Ellington from a theoretical
mm-hmm.
perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And the class was taught by the late Mark Tucker. And the class had been weeded out, literally. It was a painful, brutal experience. He gave a theory test. So you had, at one point, this room filled with so many African-American students and writers and people who want to learn, finally, about Duke Ellington. And this is going to be the, you know, ivory tower perspective and all.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gives this theory test, which is just about music and symbols. And, of course, then I'm the only black person left standing, as far as I recall. Because who goes to Columbia University to then just study music theory?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, that's kind of the part leads to what Jason's talking about with just staying the course,
mm-hmm.
which is like I have not done a lot of practical things in my life. It would be much more practical to get an English degree or a history degree even or, you know, whatever people who make sense do. Political science, I had lots of sensible, brilliant friends who have that degree, and they're making a lot of money or they're, you know, making an impact in the world in that way. But, you know, I'm like, no, I'm going to be a music major. I didn't research the major. I didn't even think about it. It's just like, well, I like music. I'm going to be a music major. Boom. Which I did, which is the only reason I got to stay in that course, which changed my life.
Mm.
Changed my life. But that's like when you kind of begin to feel that you're chosen for something because your decisions are, they're outside of any sense. You're just following something else, and you've created a life wherein this is even feasible to people or attractive. So I stayed in that class, and I was a woman, and I didn't have the technical knowledge of jazz and or a rugged, you know, beard the way half the class did or smell of cigarettes. So I kind of lent something to that course that was very unique and very different, and it was almost like practicing being Jason's partner in art now that I think about it. I never have thought about this, but, you know, I also took a composition class, several, at Columbia, and this is all focusing on late 20th century, early, well, yeah, at the time, well, that's all we had, 20th century composition, and, again, rooms full of dudes. There were some notable women, but, you know, lots of guys smelling like cigarettes who stay up 12 hours through the night writing their symphony. And, you know, these are 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old young men. And so my experience with them, too, that showed me something about the mastery thing. Like, I don't think I want to be a composer because I don't really want to stay up all night like this. And the chance to really be with a pool of guys equally unsensible, really going for their fulfilling something inside calling, like that's their sense of swagger. That's like what they're really going to compare when they get to the kind of party they're going to go to. Yeah, man, it stayed up all night, writing this all, God, the third movement's killing me. Like, you know, you get attracted to certain kind of people, and I just developed, definitely wasn't a physical attraction, but I would say I began to understand the modes by which, like, yeah, I'm looking at the young version of somebody that I think I actually admire out there who might be dead, right? Like Beethoven or somebody. Yeah, here's live ones, real in jeans. So I don't know. By the time I got to Manhattan School of Music, I think I felt slingshotted. I couldn't believe how many of that person there were there. Jason and I started out as friends. I couldn't believe I had met a black man who thought it was cool that I knew who Duke Ellington's go-to trombonist was in the 1940s. You know, like, he thought it was cool. I could open my mouth and not make a mistake with this man. Do you know how rare that is? Because I'm a different kind of a girl, young woman, and lady. Just not the same. And I don't care. So it's not like it's going to stop or get adorable for you. And, you know, I really love men. So I've had great father figures in my life, including an actual one, my dad. And I think also in Jason, his tremendous upbringing and the kind of broad sense of love that he walks inside of is the same one that I have. I'm likely to meet a person I don't know in the school and be like, yeah, we probably have something in common and we could be friends. That's part of walking around with a smile on my face. So I'm always shocked when there's somebody who's like, oh, God, that girl who smiles. Ugh. But it tells me something about either an opportunity with a person or kind of, you know, let me back off this person. They have a different life experience that, given the same smile in the hallway, they're going to come to a completely different and violent conclusion than you know, this also guides me through, just if you put yourself out there a little bit in your weirdness and your smiliness or your whatever, and the same, I guess, the opposite then must be true, that brusque, aggressive quality in other people, that where that's the first thing you meet about them, that gets them a certain kind of coterie, and they probably travel through the world with a certain kind of protection that they've learned.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my way, but it is my way to accept that there's more than one way.
Right. As your relationship progressed, what were some of the things that kept you growing together? And some of the things that you imagine, you were like, oh, wait a minute, this could be a problem.
Well, it's frustrating when, let's just say that, it's frustrating because there's two things at play. One is it's amazing that you have a partner that understands the craft that you spent all your life cultivating. That's unbelievable. The other side is we're always talking about our craft to each other, or we're talking about our kids, and there's no off switch for that. Now, that's not necessarily the worst thing in the world, because we both are trying to achieve a certain level of professionalism within our games. But, you know, I think what always has kept us inspired, at least within each other, I'll say Alicia to me, is her willingness. Like, she talks about this part about kind of like putting herself out there in a way that is probably extremely original only to Alicia. And whether this is in performance, you know, in performance, or it's in a casual conversation with one of my bosses, or, you know, and that is like, you know, like when people see Alicia and I like together, they're like, oh, this is going to be a good interaction. Like, I feel this kind of like pull towards like, oh, what are they going to say to me today? Because we both fly off at the mouth with immense amount of ideas really quick and really strong and really try to help a person out most of the times in ways that they aren't ready to accept about themselves. Because I think we've had to accept a lot of things about ourselves that we were ready or not ready to attain. And now with children, that becomes the biggest focus, is how to raise like our parents raised us, how to raise children that then also see that there are options, that there are just simply options. Options for good behavior, options for bad behavior. But hopefully they'll side on the good behavior side. But, you know, like, so that a child feels that those options are there. That's what, you know, our conversations are generally revolving around, but also keeping us kind of focused.
Alicia?
What was the question? Exactly. Jason, I'm so I'm totally thinking about what you were saying.
Well, I had a feeling that the interview was going to go that way because I'm really asking you kind of connector questions, like how do you guys connect as a couple? And, you know, one of the things that came up from, oh, my God, they're powerful together, you know, as powerful together as they are singularly, the question was, as your relationship progressed over time, what were some of the things that kept you going together? And then what were some of the things that you might imagine would be a challenge?
I would say I have always been Alicia, for whatever that is. I've always felt myself. But once I met Jason and he and I found this agreement that, yeah, Alicia's okay, then I think in my own mind, I became unstoppable. Unstoppable does not mean successful. But I just was not going to stop anything I had come to the table with, and I was going to grow, and we would both nurture the best of the things that would be produced by that. You know, and I think likewise, those early girlfriends I made at Barnard, I can mention them by name because they're professional women in their own careers that are Googleable and would tell much about my viewpoints on the world. And that is Claire Brinberg, who's a television producer, Ayanna Bird, who is a writer and has a great reissue of her book, Hair Story Out.
I just interviewed
out.
Her.
Hello. Hello.
Yeah.
That's why Jason met me. What did he say? I had chopped off all my hair. I had a short natural, Jason. That's what I have. Short.
Okay.
Yes. And I wore that hairstyle for 10, 15 years. I just, you know, grew it out. But I'm going to probably chop it off a third time pretty soon. And then, have I gone through my list? Oh, Asali Solomon, who is a fantastic writer and really keeps me thinking about how I am not attaching to the ongoing civil rights movement at moments, and that's important. You know, like my dad with the mastery. Don't talk a big game when you know you're not done everything you can do. Really do what you can do, and don't even speak about it. That's like more the kind of path I'm trying to take with that. Because with my dad, you know, it's like when you put all in, you can go all out, and you can say anything.
Yeah.
But otherwise, temper yourself and do more work. So there's that. And Asali Solomon, her sister, who is an incredible writer and short nonfiction or fiction writer, and she was commissioned by Jason on a project, The Quilts of G's Bend, and that was a very fruitful collaboration, I think, for all of us.
I think
so
we
these are women...
I think we said Asali twice, so I think you meant Akiba, right?
Akiba
and Asali.
You know, I'm getting confused. Let's
it's
just
okay,
say.
But I know you're sure.
Claire Brinberg, right. Asali Solomon, Akiba Solomon, Ayanna Bird, and Evan Van Domelen, Van Domelen Gonzalez, who taught me more about women's health than I ever wanted to know or be responsible for. My goodness. She does public health policy, and also counseling for young girls, and my goodness, the state of things there. So I just feel pretty well-rounded with my core set of women that I met when I was very young, and they delivered me to this guy I met when I was kind of young, Jason, and this is how I'm rolling.
And it should be noted also that I mean, when she mentions those people, like, I remember the first time I had to meet all of them, and I felt I met all of them, and a couple of more, like, Alicia kind of, like, said, oh, here are my friends, and then Alicia left the room.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, wow. Okay, because
you're
not your average woman.
But you have to be a real strong man to do that, because I knew them as undergraduates when I was in grad school, and that's no small task, sir. So,
yeah. I think I retreated to Alicia's keyboard and just started making a beat or something, and I was like, I don't even know what to do with this much energy. And I thought I knew, and I know strong women in my family, but I didn't know strong women like that.
And
Alicia
Sierra,
really,
Caldu Diarra was also in that room. And running the national marketing for Urban League. So, and you know, and some other people. Oh, Jason, you've gone through. This is a test of fire. I think a man that can be exposed to women who have their own ideas about things and are very happy to share them with you, and they're not all about a music video or a hairbrush, any man's in trouble. And I think that, and that's a joke, not in trouble, but any man can really really elevate his state in life, because that's a really tough room to get out of. I think way more difficult than a group of men, because men, I think, by and large, are very kind to each other around the edges of intellect and ego. They know how to make amends. Every 2 minutes, there's an agreement in a room full of men, even when they're arguing.
Right.
But in women, you know, there's much, I think, a higher likelihood that they're going to leave the room and somebody's going to have some acrimony if things don't go well in the conversation. There's not an amends that's get like a check-in every 2 minutes once women are in a truth-speaking mode. And I think the push and pull of that kind of style has been wonderful. Jason's very charismatic. I've told many people that my mother likes him more than she likes me. She loves people, but I know she likes Jason more than me. But it's because she's so smart. And Jason is ultimately likable. And I know that. So there are maybe parts of my intellectual go-in that have gotten a little sharper and or a little more blunt, depending upon how I'm using it,
right.
Because I know that Jason is there with the smile and the more concise wrap-up,
mm-hmm.
you know? He's a likable, clear kind of guy. And he doesn't press people to the wall as much.
Right. It's interesting. The first time I reconnected with you after seeing you as an undergrad was, I think, at an event for Sarah Lewis.
Yes.
And thank you for saving me, because I had some crazy allergic reaction to something I ate, and you went into parental mode, and that was really cool. So I appreciate it.
I like outliers.
Right. You're like, right.
Symptoms.
You need Benadryl. I'm like, okay, I got this. And that was the first time I met Jason. You guys lit up the room, no question. And I really appreciate, as a side, one of the big things that I talk with friends who are in transition and young people about is the importance of a dedicated circle of people that you trust, truth tellers. So I appreciate so much you naming that dedicated circle and you talking about they contribute to you. I just think that is the grace that we have between kind of life and death on the planet is having, if you have a few of those people, you know, if you have one of those people, you're blessed. If you have many of them, you're just, you know, beyond riches. So I really appreciate you sharing that. But I want to get back to this relationship, because a part of the conversation that I had with my mentee was around the possibility of being her full self in a relationship that wasn't mediated by sort of pop cultural definitions of who she could be, finding someone like a Jason who, you know, just, again, the optic of the husband and the wife and the wife and the husband having amazing gifts that they can share together.
Mm-hmm.
One, so the first question is to go back to the Cupid era, because, you know, we're right at Valentine's Day. When did you know that you wanted to marry each other?
So it's funny. Very funny. I mean, I knew pretty early. I would never admit that to Alicia. I mean, I feel like when I fall over head over heels over a woman like Alicia, it was pretty easy to see. You meet her family, you're like, oh, these people are really great. You know, they strive for excellence. You know, like, oh, her family lives up in the Northeast. I'm removed from Houston, Texas, so I'm kind of yearning this aspect of family. And so for me, it was pretty early on. And I think maybe after about four, we dated for 7 years or 8 years before we got married. So it was, you know, I met her when I was 20 years old, and I got married when I was 28. And so there's a long period of really kind of being together. And then we lived together only for 1 year of those 7 years dating. So it was, you know, that was a very conscious decision for both of us. We were still in love with each other, but we knew we weren't ready for marriage yet, even though I was ready in my mind to be with her. But also, when you're trying to become an artist or a musician, and kind of there's no safety net financially, so how do you start to build a career? And so I was really trying to fixate on that as well as our relationship. But it was pretty early on, I'll admit.
Alicia?
Yes, okay. I'm definitely here.
You're like, I'm thinking through it.
I keep a pretty close journal, and I think just by the entry of Jason into the journal, I already knew, like, the day I met him, probably, just in the language that I use.
I'll interject right now, because I have to at least admit this to some degree, and however much therapy I still need around it too. But today, like February, I admit this because today is my mother's birthday, and there are some images of Alicia and I taken together where we don't look like partners as much as we look like siblings. Where there's a picture of Alicia and she looks like my brother, you know. And then there's a picture of Alicia and she looks like my mother. I wouldn't say that was initially what was attracting me to her, but I also feel that part of, you know, like people in a tribe, and you find your people in a tribe, you know, generations later, like Alicia is, we were like looking for each other in that tribe and found each other. So, I mean, I really feel like she's a part of, has been a part of how I was being raised, And I think in the same way she saw a bit of some reflection in how I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
That made it simple for us to then see that we could also have a full life together through its ups and its downs and its joys and its sorrows too.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. using my circle of women educators in my life and reading the answer Jason just gave, what I would say about that is there's physical characteristics that his mother has as a much darker complected woman than he is.
Mm-hmm.
Jason is very, very fair. His mother is a brown-skinned woman with hair with a lot of texture, and I am those things too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that something in Jason's upbringing that made him go towards the less fair half of his parentage for his mate, that's very telling about the kind of self-love that he's capable of and that exists within that place in Houston where he's from.
Right.
I mean, that's mild. I mean, someone else would just see me and say no.
Right.
No thank you. No
uh-huh.
thank you to that little bitty bit of hair you got. No thank you to none of the rest of it.
Right.
And
right.
I think that, so the miracle of us walking, or not walking down the street, though, Jason, come on, there will be women who will just stop us and just give Jason points just because he's so clearly in love with me. And, I mean, that's painful for me to say. But this is true. And I'm not an unattractive woman. I'm not trying to give anybody any eye rolls on the other end of this radio in any way. But for those of you who know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. And then, meaning Jason's getting black woman cred all over the place because he has chosen a black woman for his mate when clearly he has other things in his own visage that are available to him as his, you know, as his equal in that way I think men sometimes think. Then when we went to Brazil, we were a mixed couple. I have never had an experience paralleling anything like that feeling. So
right.
that it's like I'm his housekeeper or his assistant or something, and
right.
he's the young, dapper gentleman. That's exactly how I felt the entire time. So even I became a little tentative about, you know, when we went to a finer restaurant, like being there with him, it displaced my sexuality into a category that I'm usually not in, meaning one of kind of some extra prowess, in a sense.
Yeah.
Does this make
yeah.
sense?
As I'm listening to this, though, I have to tease this out a little bit because, I don't know, as I experience the two of you, I mean, your optics on in person, first of all, are stunning. But even kind of online and social media, you know, we're all friends on Facebook, and sometimes I see pictures of the two of you, and I literally gasp for air. And
aww.
I don't know if it's – I mean, I just love the two of you as a couple because I love what you two bring to one another that I can see. I mean, I knew you for a little teeny bit of time as an undergraduate, and so to watch you over time kind of evolve into the woman that you are, and to actually hear you articulate your perspective as a woman who is connected to this man who is defined writ large in the world as, you know, the thing. Like, your man
yes.
is the thing. You know that your man is the thing. You two have had an interesting career trajectory, too, right? So there are times when you were together as you were figuring out your own voice, he was figuring out his, and he was having a certain level of public success. You guys
yes.
know what's going on behind closed doors. I mean, part of this, again, is when you connected in school, and then you decided to be together, and then you decided to marry each other, you still know that Jason is a force, but God knows, Jason knows that Alicia is a force. You both are very powerful in your own right, and you have a very clear and strong sense of your artistic ambition. So I think also the curiosity for me and probably people who watch you is how you tend to balance your needs along the way, because I know that I've read some things from you, Alicia, where You've talked about how important it was to have conversations with Jason about your desires and the time you need in a day to do that.
Yes.
So how did that evolve along the way as well?
Well, I'm victorious in that former narrative.
Right.
I did used to talk about that a lot. And now that's over. Since Porky and Bess, I mean, Broadway, the concept of Broadway singing is not something that even entered my mouth up until I got this job to do this. It is not even a dream come true because it's not even a dream I bothered to have. I never saw myself singing mainstream Broadway material. And this kind of isn't that. It's like this amazing bit of luck where, yeah, this is quintessential Broadway, except you have to have a lifetime of classical training to do this one.
Sure.
And then, boom. Oh, and it's Gershwin, so there's a lot of jazzy feel. Can you do that? Are you kidding me? I was born to do this. I want to do this, born to do this, but only by a kind of pathway of other decisions which weren't quite practical all throughout. So I'm happy to be here, and I'm also relieved, and I think Jason's relieved, which is why he's supporting me in this, doing this national tour, is that he didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Like, this is not a world where he knows anybody, and likewise, not a world where anybody knows him until now, like, on Broadway, I want to say roundabout midnight. That's not roundabout midnight. It's
after midnight.
After midnight. Or, like, you know, then there's guys in the band who are jazz musicians. They know. Like, there's, you know, just little there's connections between that world. And my point being that this is really my own. Like, everything we have worked on together in me, in music, and part of him working on me in music is to allow me into his sandbox and throw stuff around as I see fit sometimes. So, you know, kind of taking on that apprentice role on the bandstand. And, you know, well, girl, sink or swim. See what you can do.
Right.
And, you know.
But you know what? Here's the thing, though, because I'm listening to you and I feel like, you know, when I heard the news, well, first of all, when I heard the news about the study, I was like, And actually, Caroline Eiffel, who's the president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, she went to see Porgy and Bess on one of the nights when Audra was unable to perform and you stepped up. And she tweeted out, she's like, honey, child, let me tell you something about this woman. I got chills and I was laughing so hard because I love when my worlds intersect that way. But, I mean, Jason, this is kind of a question for you. I don't hear what you're saying as, oh, my gosh, happy accident, I didn't think. I feel like, in a way, your very stick-to-itiveness to your own path and your own voice, in my estimation, created this moment for you. I believe that you absolutely earned it, and I believe that you created it. There was a force in Alicia that said, when I step up to the stage will welcome me as I am in my own unique gifts, and it will give me an opportunity to shine, and that's what this is doing. I don't know. It's just me. I could be wrong.
No, you're right.
Yes, but you have no faith that that stage will appear for you.
Right.
So the agreement of the greater art society and culture and the Gershwins and whomever, that they're going to do this. Those things take 20, 15,
Absolutely.
10, 5 years to come to the table. So that they're having an idea at the same time I'm eschewing this and eschewing that and sticking my guns and working, like, at the Gap during college, not trying to sing chorus gigs, or working for Simon Shama, art historian, for 5 years during the time when someone else might be trying to fly to Europe and audition or do audition for opera companies or do that. I didn't do one audition like that. I said, I need to make money so I can keep taking lessons because I just want to have a better and better and better understanding of my own voice. I was kind of addicted to that.
Yeah.
And I gave up a lot of middle-type opportunities or at least even striving for those things in an effort to support my own education continuing in my voice, because it just seemed to me logically that when you get to the table, you might have a long resume, but you also then have to sing for those people in a meaningful way, meaning try to make them cry right now on the spot. That became a goal for me. And if I couldn't do it and I knew somebody else was better, why am I even here? So I just didn't audition for things if I didn't impress myself in the practice room, and I wasn't. So I worked, and but then why do I think that all of a sudden I'm going to be having all these jobs in the art world? I'm working for a great art historian, New Yorker art critic, and writer about history and culture on both sides of the pond. While I'm working for him, he decides he's going to do his book about black Africans fighting in the Revolutionary War on the British side. Now, certainly his interest in it predated my existence in his life.
Right.
But that I was there the moment when he took that to the press. So me working for this man, I'm learning who writes and reviews such books.
Yeah.
I'm understanding the kind of venues that book a concept like this. I'm making up my own ideas. I invited him to do a piece about his book with Jason and I that involves singing, and Jason wrote a beautiful piano suite for it, and we performed it at Symphony Space for the teeniest audience, thanks to Lamore Tomer, who used to produce work there. I can't tell you how many blessings I have because I am open to the oddness in people.
Yeah.
And kind of am obsessed by my own processing of all the truth in the environment or in a room that never gets said. People talk and talk and talk, and I do write down the information. I take very good notes. I'm a good student. But I always feel like that's not why I came here. Sometimes it's just that little accidental occasion, that little brush on the shoulder and how someone responded to it, that's going to be my next piece. Like, it's only going to be about that shoulder bump I had in the hallway. And I have so much source material to use because I've taken so much notes about the basic thing that's happening in the room. But, like, I just kind of don't understand sometimes living my day, why people are talking to me, not here, certainly, but just, I don't know, back in New York sometimes, just when I'm the mom, they might be talking to you. It's like, are we... Wait a minute. Are we in the same place to get...
Right.
Okay. First of all, you don't know who you're talking to. And it don't mean that I have more value on this earth than you. It doesn't mean I'm better than you. But I mean, literally, you don't know who you're talking to. So you either are interested in who you're talking to or you're not. Now, if you really care about what you want out of this conversation, you will get dead curious about who I am, because that's whereby you might get it in the next few moments. So for people who don't take that view about life or a conversation, sometimes I have been accused of mowing them down. But that's not based on anything. It's just my urgency to know what the hell you are talking about and when can we achieve what we are here for. And, I mean, that goes from everything from buying gas at a place where the plexi is so thick they can't hear you.
Yeah.
Meaning, do you know who I am? I want to buy gas. I want to buy something. No. Or, you know, from a more meaningful transaction. And I just need life out of people.
Yeah, there seems to be a need for efficacy in a way in what you are striving to do in all things.
Something. It could be a mess, too. And I don't know why people think it can't be a mess. It certainly fits into my dad's thing about mastery and excellence, because I change what my goal is. My thing is not to be on point, perfect, back, attitude, relevant. Like, no, I didn't do ballet because it involves all that. I kind of want to, and I don't have the body for that, and I'm not that dumb. I have made the game in the moments be about what I know I can contribute to the greater work, not how I can show my pretty legs. It's about that. It's like, really, this chunk of art could use some of this. And I think people in the environment that have been looking for that just would. Bill T. Jones is a perfect example. Somebody I never thought I would meet in person in a million years. I did, and I basically did an art performance piece for him in 20 seconds because I know his work so well. And I know what I needed from him from my anecdote of him. Mm-hmm. Smokey Robinson, same thing. I mm-hmm. saw that man. I had a clear shot. I asked Jason because I was at his job, can I talk to him and I will be good, I promise. And I was good. But I got my 20 seconds with the man, and you know what? They don't want you to take their picture. They don't want you to give their argument. They're not interested. That's from your point of view. My thing was, I'm going to tell you really quick how I've devoted the past 5 years of my life to one song that you wrote, and here's what I did with it. Can I please perform it for you? Very quickly, quietly, right in this corner while you eat your salad. And I so did. But it was all about him. It was what I did with his words. And I don't want a record deal. I didn't tell him my name. It's just not about that. It's like I can't believe I get this chance to make this deposit in the world of my imagination and art, and now it's being made real. I'm getting down from this. And, you know, that man's so kind and gracious. It's unbelievable. And his wife is so beautiful and so kind and so gracious. These people, you can see right then a monument of American success. It's like read in moments like that. That's where the integrity, the fault lines are not even perceptible. You're never going to see them, not from this far away. Mm-hmm. And it gives me a lot of information about how Jason and I will be when we're in our 60s. And first of all, I definitely want to look as fine as his wife. I have a lot of work to do. Beautifully put together. And for him to, no, Jason, keep eating your peanuts. This kid is going to show you what he did to your song from 35 years ago.
Yeah,
break me down. Make me cry right now. That's like beauty to me. And every other thing is so fine for somebody else. But you just have to know what you're trying to get out of a moment. Like, milk it for what?
That's all I have to say. It's deep because before I go into this question, Jason, tell me what it's like when you watch Alicia perform, and Alicia, tell me what it's like when you watch Jason perform.
First of all, Alicia does so many different types of performances, so I'll just start with the one she's doing right now, which is Best, is Porgy and Bess. You know, I've watched her perform this maybe 20 times, and, you know, what is always intriguing is she's relentless in the investigation of the role, whatever the role is. Mm-hmm. When she was on Broadway, the role was way in the back, and she was relentless in that role, waiting for that phrase of music to happen. And there's like an increasing curiosity she has about her position in whichever piece it is, whether it's working with Bill T. Jones or it's working with my band or working in Porgy and Bess or doing her Motown project. So she's relentless in her kind of investigation of what the role is and how it will engage the audience. And that's a real true performer.
Alicia, about Jason.
Watching Jason is, for me, the same. It's like he is going to show you something. I never know what it will be. And the amount that you have to know about where you are to take any step in any direction into the darkness with full poise is, I think, something that's hard for people to reconcile.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like too much. It's so much easier to say, I practice every day. I practice for 6 hours a day. That's why I am good. With him, he's practicing 24 hours a day. And that sounds silly, but it's really true.
Mm-hmm.
Because nothing is, what is that? Compartmentalized?
Mm-hmm.
Really? It's definitely the best seat in the house when I'm performing with him and I get to watch him play. So much so that when we just were in San Francisco, at San Francisco Jazz together, I offered that position to a young man in the audience. Jason had a long, he was playing an extended solo, and I get to watch the hammers hit the strings up top, and his face and his hand, everything. And I saw a kid, he was very intently watching, and I told, during the solo, went in the audience and brought the kid there to watch the the fireworks, because it just seemed selfish for me to just be there when I know what he can do. It's kind of brilliant, too, to not fully understand the technical prowess involved, but just kind of perceive them like fireworks. It's thrilling. I probably don't understand what I'm watching. It's that good. And I have long since stopped telling other people to come check them out or, oh, my husband's really good, because it goes so far beyond that. And I we just I just wait. You know, we're waiting. That's how it feels. And also, he's very handsome in a unique way. I like him a
lot.
He's
very unique.
Nice.
What about
he's
when
good, you know? Though. Sometimes I do worry. In, I used to. I don't anymore. But when he was more on the come up, on the placement, he'd be in these double bills, and they'd be putting him first. I was like, oh, don't do that. He's going to take all the honey out of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Till this more famous person is going to get on the bandstand and won't be able to get a drop, because it's not what they do. It's not where they've been focused, on the audience and making them feel real things about where they are, sharing that air in the room right then for real. They have been up to something else, like often very usefully making the infrastructure of jazz strong and sending wonderful examples of the American art form around the world in clockwork fashion. I mean, the gratitude, I mean, who can besmirch anyone else for anyone to say these guys this or those guys that, or as they say, these cats this or that cat that. I have to tell you, from where I stand, just as a wife on the outside, I don't get it. Like, you don't see you need all of you? You don't. You can't see that? What, you don't like third graders and ninth graders, but you really want awesome fourth graders and college graduates? I mean, this makes no sense. Sometimes people move their place, and that can be threatening. Like, I would support you as a third grader if I didn't think you were going to come up into my fifth grade. That's a dangerous energy, and I know for a fact Jason don't take any part of that, and we don't. I don't either. That's a dangerous game to play.
Right.
And when people, it's time for their greatness, is nothing going to stop them?
I agree with that.
Nothing.
I agree with that. I agree with that.
So I have to say, be great. But in that moment with Jason, when you just realize, oh, my gosh, my fiancé is about to kill this, and nobody else knows yet, that was kind of an exciting place for me that artistically, in my own work, gives me a lot of excitement, because I've gotten to see someone just be a student and then, you know, direct the creative programming at Jazz at Kennedy Center.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Kennedy Center Jazz. Oh, my goodness, those little words inside. So, you know, I feel about my own career, I feel like I'm walking in a room, you don't have to know who I am, I don't have to know who I am, and I don't have to get up a good sentence about it or anything. I'm just going to do some stuff. And then the next day, I'm going to do it a different way. That's going to teach me if I can do this perhaps better, or if what I did the first day was better and I need to drop the second way. And I encountered some frustration in Broadway as the understudy. I was really going for it. And I had a wonderful director in Diane Paulus and Nancy Harrington, our production stage manager. And I kind of made it clear very early on that I didn't necessarily speak, but I am an artist and a musician, so we can talk that any day. And I've seen a million Broadway shows, just from the audience, though. So we have to talk about myself as I'm in the audience of myself. And once we kind of made some changes about how to talk about it, and I was referred to a wonderful acting teacher in New York, who I could just tell my real ideas about art and explain, no, this is my husband, and this is what we do, and he wanted to meet my twins, and he met my twin boys. Somebody who's willing to really put together something from the ground up, these are always the people I'm looking for. Anybody who wants me to bam, bam, do the tap dance, girl, sell it, work it, boom, that's the end. Mm, that's not really where I'm great.
That's not how you work. Right.
Not really at all. I always will give that job to anybody else any day because I have figured out as much as I love to consume it in other people, that's not what I do.
Right, right. What is collaborating, the two of you collaborating, like? I mean, I know that you both have very distinct artistic ideas, but when you bring them together for collaborations, and you've done several, what is that process like for you?
Fight.
Yeah, it's a lot of fighting. We're being honest when we say that. It's a lot of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Because our processes are also very different. How Alicia mm-hmm. approaches something is not how I approach something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always in the rehearsal process really waiting for the performance because in the performance I'm going to show you what this will be. Alicia's like, no, I want to hear what the performance is right now. I can't do that. Like she talks about not being able to just snap and then impress someone. I can't do that in a rehearsal. But what ends up happening is through those fights, of course, there's always makeup periods. And right there's about 5 minutes after the fight when something turns, generally in me, to say, oh, well, what about trying it this way? And then the process starts again, like, oh, okay, well, this is a fresh space. And Alicia always says, well, why did I have to yell at you for 20 minutes for you to do that?
Oh,
and
sorry.
This is that's honest. It's just what it is. And, I mean, but, you know, like, coaches yell at players all the time. And musicians yell at other musicians all the time, too. This is how people sometimes learn to improve. But also, then what happens in the performance is this magical energy that is kind of fueled not only by the ideas we both have, but also by the process we went through to even get to these ideas mm-hmm. and then perform them on the stage. And that gets very heavy. I mean, I want to say that, I mean, our best collaboration is our children. Second behind that is our collaboration in making this 5-day kind of festival called Bleed at the Whitney Biennial, which was 30 different performances with like about 90 different performers. And we curated the hell out of that thing, 5 days of, you know, unbelievable performances. And that was a real kind of display of how we both think about ideas, you know, just ideas, whether they were, you know, an editorial writer or whether they were a dancer or whether it was children or whether it was, you know, video art. And it's a crowning achievement for us. That this was the type of event that we could imagine, that the museum could not imagine, and only by the two brains of us, and then by all of the support and help from our friends and collaborators, were we able to make something extremely special for New York City and for the people who came to visit those days. So it's, you know, it's a thing that we rely on each other for. I mean, Alicia has been my collaborator for nearly all of my recordings. And most of my projects that have been multimedia projects, and they have been successful because of her voice within those pieces. I'm quick to admit that.
I think that Jason takes what he wants from any environment willfully and without permission. So only understanding that about him do I accept him saying things like, she had a hand in every recording I've ever made. Because certainly I feel that I have not. And I think that though that might be the mark of what is great about being married to an artistic collaborator and partner is that it doesn't matter. You know, what's his is mine, and what's mine is his. To a degree, even though our most there's no vehemence with Jason, so that's also not true. And when I say we fight, I mean we will laugh and we will fight. In Norway, we're in Norway. Jason had this illustrious post. See, this is one of those things where it's way more amazing when you get there than what he told you it was. So Yeah, I'm in charge of like 4 days of music, and yeah, it's in Norway. Yeah. No, you get there and you get off the plane and it's his big face plastered up over the whole town. And like the last person who did it was Sting and blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
So it's very, it wasn't Sting, but it's fun trailing him around the world because it's like these secrets of who he is that at home he doesn't even bother to take out the bag. And I get it. Because I'll talk to people I don't even bother to say. Because, yeah, my husband's a musician. Yeah, he's very good. End of story at this point. What can I tell you? I don't remember what the question was, which is very typical to me. Oh, yeah, what's his is mine, what's mine? Because, see, that's what I mean. You really can't say the truest things. You kind of have to feel your way through them. And he once told me there wasn't anything I could do to him. And let's not ever test this, but he said there wasn't anything I could do to him to make him leave me. Mm-hmm. And I said, really? Not anything? And I think the thing there is that there's behavior and then there's context. And Jason has bought spiritually and wholly into my context for things because that's what I think he's given me credit for in all his other artworks, is like the context within which the thought is happening. You know, we'll look at it. I'll be like, that's a dumb title. Things like that will cut him, so he might change the title. And I'm not thinking anything about it. I'm thinking I'm talking to this great artist in the world. What would he care what I think? But, you know, he cares a lot. And so we are our own. I know if I can get an idea past Jason, I'm doing great. I had an idea for him on the phone 2 nights ago. He fell asleep, and literally I have forgotten what the idea and the conversation was, meaning I was very fired up about it. But he fell asleep, so now I'm not that interested in it anymore. That's a litmus, and I trust it. We're so rehearsed at it now. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm pretty lucky that way. But about Norway, I wanted to say we played a song in the sound check. And people are watching you in the sound check because nobody knows who I am and everybody knows who he is the idea. And I just hated how it made me feel. It's a beautiful piece of music, and whatever we were doing to it, it was just like putting ham sandwich inside of this thing. It felt horrible. So we went up to the room, the green room, before I'm changing into my dress, and I'm just like verbally gutting that song, and it's supposed to be the song we open with in a huge deal, and I just hated it. So I'm talking about everything I don't like about it, and it kind of seems negative, and I think to someone else it might be like, you're just beating me up and I can't take it. But I know what he's capable of, and I know what I'm capable of, and I knew that we had not done the work. There goes my dad again. I can be rough on this because we didn't do the work. If you had done the work, you earn a different level of language around it. You didn't think about it. You stole it from MTV2. It's a dumb title. I'm going to say it. You didn't think about it. It doesn't mean you're horrible. It means it's not thoughtful. Dumb, as in dull, as in not feeling, as in not reacting to the environment for survival. Dumb. It is dumb. And the way we did that piece was ham-fisted, and it's not going to happen. And I said, it just needs to feel like da-da-da. And I don't remember what piece I said it needed to feel like that we have, but I'm telling you, Jason Moran came out to the piano. He played an introduction, and see, right there is the communion.
Yeah.
It's like, woman, you're burning me up, but I know this is not about you. It's not the Alicia show. It's like this music needs to be right. And if it would ever be the Alicia show, it will only be once all that music has been established.
Right.
I don't get any other kind of pass in this world. That's not my place. I always have to, like, sing my butt off or give some ideas or both. I feel like I really work for a living. I sing for a living. I don't care how old I am. I'm on my prove it to me years. And they might last forever, and that might be okay.
Right.
And Jason is the partner for that. He is the partner for that. He came with something I had never heard before because he's capable of it. And I didn't care that it wasn't good because I had never heard it before. That's a great misunderstanding about improvisation and a great misunderstanding about art in general. This has all been rehearsed and weathered, and by twisting the chord of meaning around the chord of complete unnuance and stereotype, and I've heard this a million times before and I'm not interested and it's hurting my feelings like ham, he made this new thing. It's like wrapping a vine around a tree. It just choked the badness and created the flowers of all this beauty that he knew I needed in order to perform for this. This place was jammed, 1,000 people who don't know me across many oceans, and I can in this moment be, she's a great singer, or he just toted his wife along for the tax break or whatever. I don't think so. Not on any day. And right. It was the biggest concert of the week from the spiritual plane. It's like the midnight show on the last night in the chapel. Girl, you better bring it. And part of me bringing it is to stoke the fire in my accompanist. And some people do that in many different ways. But the way I had to do it is like very, oh, man, life. It feels in the moment like life or death, when really it's just a song. But it's never just a song.
But, you know, you guys do that, though, because in your performances, especially Bleed and all the other things that I've seen, unfortunately not in person, I will definitely be changing that. You really respect and serve your audience. Let me say that again. You really, both of you individually and together and with all of your collaborators, I get this sense that, you know, looking at your body of work as I've been able to, you respect your audience. You know that you're there to serve them. I was wondering what was going on, what goes on for each of you or individually or even in collaborations during rehearsal, during live performances. Were you kind of set the stage for being the channel where you shared those gifts with us?
I don't know. We both have watched a lot of concerts over the years, too, and we've been taught by some of the, you know, great practitioners of our respective art forms, and they are great practitioners of it. Mm-hmm. And there's a thing that you learn about a performer and their graciousness that they have with not only their ability but with their audience and how they transmit that from stage or recording to a person sitting in a seat 100 feet away from you. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, I've seen it done various ways by many different people, and some to successful degrees and some unsuccessfully. And I've always felt, I mean, it took me a while to figure it out, but you also have to, I had to figure out what was my way of doing that and how would I want to have my audience feel, that they were being lectured to or that they were being coaxed into a room that they weren't sure if it had, you know, a pit of snakes in it, you know. I want to lead you places. And I definitely don't want any audience to feel like they already know what they're going to get when they arrive.
Yeah.
And I'm positive as an improviser, Alicia is also an improviser, but as we both improvise on the stage, it's also about maintaining that level of uneasiness, not only with each other to kind of keep us on our toes, as she says, stoking the fire, but also keeping an audience on their toes too. And that there are lots of people out there with, you know, varying cultural setups that come to a performance feeling any variety of emotional ways once they sit down. And our duty, I always thought, was then to, like, if you could transport them, then transport them. Some, you know, painters do it with paintings, Van Gogh or Monet, or people do it with dance, and people do it with, you know, comedy, and, you know, people do it with all types of forms, you know. I mean, it's always like a real pleasure sometimes even going to an auto mechanic's shop and really kind of hearing, like, a person who's really satisfied that your car has come in ailing and want to satisfy the car, you know?
Right.
Oh, I know what can... And that enthusiasm is generative also in an audience, that they feel like, oh, we're in this process together, and they're actually doing this fresh for us. They're not bringing us some stale French fries.
Right.
Saying, oh, no, this is the best thing in the world. We've tried, and this is tried and true right here. But we really want to give each one a very unique experience. And I can promise you the people who have seen it, when we were together, will say, oh, well, that was not what I was expecting. And then we'll want to know the next time, like, oh, what can I,
yeah.
what will be in store for me on the next time? That, you know, breeding that kind of anticipation is what we're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Alicia.
I was just listening. I feel good about that.
Yeah.
You guys are parents. You have two gorgeous twin boys, Malcolm and Jonas. What has parenting taught you about life and love and art?
Well, I'll start. The first thing parenting has taught me is that I need to thank my parents more often. Because if you can raise a child that actually has some bit of values and some bit of self-esteem, then the job is almost done. And some bit, and health, you know, like, you know, wow, that if that's what we can do, then that's the most amazing part. And the other thing is once we had children, it just focused all of our energy in a way where, so Alicia needs to go on the road for 9 months. Okay, so I'm coming off the road. I'm not going to teach for a year. I'm not going to tour for a year. And you, because I'll be home with the kids. I'm not going to get a nanny. I don't want a nanny. I want to be home. So, and you just do these things, not even like as this, you do them because that's what's needed at that moment, and you satisfy it. Somebody needs to pick up the kids. Somebody needs to feed them. Somebody needs to go to the hospital, you know. And these boys, they came 3 months early. These are our little miracle babies. They came out 2 pounds, you know. They stayed in the hospital for 3 months, you know. And so we're proud of them. We're proud of what they do. We're proud of their kind of their lust for life that they have. And all I want to do is just enable that. And so if I get a chance to perform, that's almost secondary to being a parent for me right now. I have a different feeling about having to be on the road all the time or having to make a new record. It's more like, well, okay, how can I just sustain tuition and at this school and there and you know, making sure that they learn what they need to learn.
Mother?
I think compassion. Not for children, but people who have them. There's no amount of inattention and uncooperativeness that couldn't be chalked up to life with a newborn in a person the next day. I mean, you some days, depending on the child you get, the sleep patterns they enjoy, you feel catatonic. And if you were in a life where you didn't have a passion for your day job, I can't even imagine. And if you have no freedom to move, you know, like Jason and I, we have become big fans of Netflix because, you know, you can pause it, you can wait. If it becomes inconvenient, you can, you know, finish it in 2 days. These are the kinds of things we need. And I'm not really trying to be funny because I really mean it about very heavy things, like more about the health of a child, the intellectual ability of a child, the tenacity of a child, the social place in the school system for the child. I mean, it's so difficult, and you can be wrapped in fear. And it uses all of your money, and if you don't have much, oh, my goodness. I mean, but yet it's the imperative of biology that we do this. So not everyone is touched by that imperative. But for those who are, certainly it's human. And it just teaches me a lot of compassion for humanity. No more of that, you know, I'm on the bus with an unruly child. Why don't those parents ... No, I get it. There's no finger wagging that's gonna be interesting or effective. You're on the wrong side of the story with that one. It's fine because it's stressful for people, and I understand stress, like the garbage truck pulling up under your window. That's stress. But a child is not a garbage truck on a schedule, and it also stinks regularly. So, you know, it's not the it's just not that kind of world. And man, it's really tough. And as enjoyable as it is, I'm pretty clear to say, and also I probably get this from my mother, that it wasn't like some beautiful or courageous or wanton irresponsible choice I made. It's just that I was tapped by Mother Nature, who told me I have to do this. It wasn't a choice. It's like a thing about who I am that I was going to do this. Mm-hmm. And I did. And I'm so glad I did it with a wonderful man, because he has, Jason as a father, has brings so much to the table, but he also has patience in process. So even as I try to figure out something as a mother, we try hard not to lay another layer on it called, well, that's what I said, or I said it first, or I told you to not tell me.
Yeah.
You know, this would make it for me unbearable. And it's unavoidable. We do have those conversations too, but you just pray they can be quick, because you're in a situation with Mother Nature. It's like a flower. Who yells at a flower? I mean, is this thing is lopsided? Well, put it in the sun. Put it in the rain. It's using all your money. Well, it's beautiful, and you want it to thrive, and you love it. We just buried a fish. I wasn't home for it, but our first of the family pets we've ever had, this is the first to ever go, and his name was Bluey. He had another name, but he's Blue, so I think Bluey stuck.
Uh-huh.
And Reddy is still alive. He's Red. But Bluey is gone, and I am on tour, so I didn't get to say goodbye to Bluey. And I'm so mad at how much I love this little nickel fish.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so angry because I feel so vulnerable to death and life, and I sing about it all day long, and it's real to me.
Mm-hmm.
But the boys brought that into my life.
Right.
And that's kind of what it just is. They bring it, you take it, it thrives, you're joyful, it dies, you move on, you help them move on. Well, though, Jason, you said they were fine with it, right?
They were very fine.
Yeah, it's only me who's really upset.
That's
classic.
Right.
Anyway,
right.
What are you going to do?
Right.
If you were not a jazz pianist, Jason, and you were not a mezzo-soprano, Alicia, who would you be?
Go ahead, Alicia.
I might try to be a politician.
Okay.
And I had a feeling about snakes and all things reptiles, so I thought I might work in a zoo.
Interesting. How can people stay abreast of your performance schedule and connect with you on social media? Alicia, we'll start with you.
Well, PorgyandBessTheMusical.com has the tour schedule for all the remaining shows of Porgy and Bess. We're going to some brilliant cities like Philadelphia next week, Los Angeles, Buffalo, Detroit, et cetera, Charlotte. And we are also AliciaHallMoran.com and AliciaHallMoran at gmail.com accessible. I'm also on Facebook.
Okay, great. And Jason?
I'll be at home with my kids every day.
That's not true.
That's not true. But that is true. I don't know. I have two big premieres coming up this spring. One is at Dartmouth College. I'm writing a new piece for the Imani Winds, a great woodwind quintet, and that'll be premiered in Dartmouth in early April. And then in May, I'm writing a big piece for Chicago Symphony Center and working with the artist Theaster Gates on a piece about the importance of Chicago's musical landscape. And that'll be premiered in late May at Chicago Symphony Center. There's tons of stuff in between, but you can find it on jasonmoran.com.
For living powerfully, lovingly, and artfully on purpose, I thank you, Alicia Hall Moran, and Jason Moran for joining me today on the AYG List, and I hope you'll return soon.
Thank you,
April. Definitely. Thank you.
You've been listening to the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. The AYG List posts every Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. April would love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and invite you to take a peek into her world on Instagram at the AYG List. Also, visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog, theayglist.com. Thank you for listening.